Hello and welcome to the Kemeny Capital Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Roy, and we're going to be discussing today the Love Ventures EIS 2 Fund. And to do that, we're kindly joined by Marcus Love, who is the partner at Love Ventures. Marcus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. Great to be on it.
So the Love Ventures EIS 2 Fund is currently raising, and we're going to be looking at a close later on this month. So we're going to be discussing the fund in general, some of the portfolio companies throughout this podcast. So to get started, Marcus, would you be able to give us a background to yourself, the other partners, and the fund?
Sure. So my background is I spent nearly 10 years in Paris. I worked in consultancy at a company called Capgemini, looking after the financial services vertical. I then went into a mobile internet startup company, so I had a startup experience, and then did various sales roles before coming back to London in 2005. And I spent 14 years in a city working in independent equity research, and latterly at a company called William O'Neill, which specializes in growth stocks. So I was looking out for the next growth stories, trying to get the best companies globally into client portfolios, and trained my mind to look for great stories and mega trends, and really the exciting new companies that were coming through in the market. And during that period, I also built up an angel investment portfolio. So in 2015, I made my first investment into an EIS eligible company. I built that portfolio up to around 20 companies. We backed companies like Revolut very early in 2016 and 2017. And my brother, Adrian, who is a co-founder and partner at Love Ventures, followed me into around 12 of those companies. And the setup at Love Ventures is we're both partners. We have a team of advisors who are very experienced to sit in our investment committee. We have other team members in both analysis and investor relations, etc. So that's our background.
Thank you. So you mentioned a couple of companies there that you invested in as an angel some years ago. Revolut was one of those. I mean, how does that compare to what you're doing at Love Ventures and the EIS fund now, in terms of, are you looking at the same sorts of opportunities in the same sector, or have you decided to go a slightly different way with the portfolio companies that you're looking at?
Yes, so what we did during our angel investments is we specialized in fintech, prop tech, and consumer tech as our three sectors. And what happened is during that syndicate, we had people at that investment portfolio. We created a syndicate and others were following us into those investments. And that was a genesis of Love Ventures. So really what we did with Fund One was deploy the same investment thesis, so into those sectors. And what we do is we invest at the last stage before Series A, that last check before Series A. That's where we operate. And if I look through the client portfolio of what we've got into, the investment portfolio, in fintech, we're in a number of exciting fintechs in the UK. And you know, that really was a follow-on from what we've been doing as angel investing. So as angels, we invested in Revolut, as I mentioned, but also companies like Chip. Chip is in the process of doing a crowdfund right now. I believe they've raised £10 million and they actually broke CrowdCube servers last Friday. So an impressive crowdfund there.
Indeed, indeed. So there's a couple of things that I'd like to pick up on there. I mean, first of all, is it look at fintech. Of course, that seems to be a theme for yourself in terms of your history of investing. How have you seen that particular theme change over the past few years? And how do you see it progressing going forward?
Yeah, so we're at the forefront of fintech investing here in the UK. So in 2020, there was about £3 billion invested into fintech. That's second only to the US. It's a very positive environment for entrepreneurs to create businesses. The FCA is very forward-thinking. It has a implementation of PSD2, which is forward-thinking, called open banking. That enables people to have a standardized data set for exchanging information. About 1.6 million people today have used open banking out of a population of 67 million. So we're in the infancy of what we're able to do. And if you've used open banking yourself, you'll know what it looks like. You are in an app which you're using and it clicks to send you through to your bank. and you go through to Barclays, HSBC, Starling, etc. You validate that connection, and it goes back to the app. And basically what it's doing is taking funds directly from your bank account. And as I said, that standardized data set allows developers to create really interesting applications that kind of sit on top of the existing banking infrastructure and framework. And that enables a lot of creativity. So we're at the forefront of that. Other countries have their own systems and ways of doing things. But if you look at the US of A, for example, they have 4,500 regional banks, a system with, 50 states, which is fairly, regional, distributed, etc. We have a system which is more uniform and enables this creativity, and means really we're at the forefront of things. And to your question about where we are in fintech, if you think of fintech of 1.0, of being, the neobanks, the likes of Revolut, etc., we're now at fintech 2.0. So in the open banking world, for example, we've supported a company called Bankt. Bankt enables merchants to offer this open banking payout solution at checkout. And merchants like it because it's got a very good security layer. It enables the merchants to have a seamless process. It also, creates a lot of transparency, and it's lower fees. So crucially for merchants, they're paying lower fees to the card providers.
So we're going to discuss some of the companies that you've deployed in the fund. But before we do that, PropTech's quite an interesting sector at the moment. Here in the UK, property is a huge part of the wealth effects of people. But you're obviously operating at the technology side of things. So how does that look like? And what sort of processes and services have caught your eyes, and how do you see that progressing going forward?
Yeah, so property is really interesting. It's a little bit behind fintech. So in terms of kind of valuations, they're about one third of where fintech is. Fintech's a little bit more developed. But it's really exciting because property is the largest asset class in the world. And within property, it's probably been the most disrupted industry in the last 18 months during the COVID pandemic. Obviously, travel, retail, other sectors have been disrupted as well. But property is probably the most disrupted sector. And disruption spells opportunity. So really what that means is there's been a wealth of new ways of working, a lot of applications that are required to assist workflows, changing habits which are now instilled in new ways of working. And so that creates a lot of opportunity. And so in the PropTech areas we've gone into, it tends to be software-based, tends to be SaaS-type solutions. My brother leads on that sector because his background is in property. He worked at Dorrington, which is a large asset manager, and previously at the Instant Group, which is a fast-growth flexible workspace solution provider. So he's had that startup experience and is able to identify companies today which display that fast growth and are in that exciting prop tech sector. And to your point about what we're seeing, I mean, it's across the range of prop tech. So prop tech's a vast sort of sector, if you like. And you see changes in the built environment and companies that are doing sensors. So if you imagine a building which you might be sending security guards around to go and monitor, these days you have sensors that are able to monitor humidity, damp, fire, smoke, all these things. So there's huge amounts of efficiencies that can come through from more modern and really more creative ways of managing property. So that helps operators, it helps asset managers. Large property operators are getting into the space. You just have to look at Fifth Wall, which is probably the largest prop tech investing firm. And they have, people like Knight Frank investing into that because that's how they want to really see what's going on in the sector, but be part of it.
So let's now look, Marcus, at some of the companies that you have in the portfolio. Now, of course, we can't go through all of them, and I'm sure all of them excite you in certain ways. But would you be able to pick out just a couple just to give listeners an idea of some of the companies that you've got in the portfolio and what they do, and what was your reasoning behind looking at a deployment in them?
Sure. I've mentioned Bankt earlier, so we'll move on to a couple of other ones. One would be a company called TyMIT, that's TyMIT. They are FCA regulated credit card by installment company. So if you're familiar with Klarna, Klarna, obviously the largest fintech company in Europe right now, they offer the ability to pay over 3 months interest free. What TyMIT do is they offer that same ability to pay over 3 months interest free, but they also offer the ability to pay by credit over 1 to 36 months in a very transparent manner, because they show you upfront what it might cost you in terms of fees and in terms of monthly installments. So, for example, if you're buying a washing machine and it's £350, you can pay over 3 months interest free, which would be £117, or you can pay over 12 months, which would be 30 something pounds plus the interest. And it's very transparent. It gives the user the ability to control their finances because they're FCA regulated. As you can imagine, they have all the checks and balances in process to make sure they're doing all their regulatory requirements and reporting. They have a very low delinquency rate. It's around 1.6%. So they have a very good loan book. And they're enabling people really to control their finances in a very sensible manner. It's quite a topical subject, as you're probably aware. It's got some quite bad press. I think merchants like it because it enables the basket size to increase. But on the flip side, it could be pushing people into debt that they can't afford to pay. And what TyMIT does is give you more control over the finances and enables people to ease the burden over several months and gives them that credit option. Whereas with Klarna, you don't get credit. You're paying over 3 months. And if you don't pay, your dossier is effectively handed to a debt collection agency. So it's probably less responsible. But that's why we backed TyMIT. When we met them, they had around 5,000 users. They've been growing very strongly since. Their business is doubling in size every 3 months or so. We went in at that last check before Series A, which is where we like to operate. And they're currently in discussions for their Series A round, which is their next round of investment, and looking for more institutional support.
So that's obviously one operating there in the fintech space. Would you be able to give listeners an idea of the types of company or an idea of a company that you've backed in the prop tech sector and what that's doing?
Sure. We'll give an example, which would be Just Move In. So Just Move In helps that pain point of moving house. We've all moved house at some point in our lifetimes. In the UK, there are 6 million moves per year. And obviously far more if you look at larger markets like the US. And it's really hard work, as you know, when you're moving house. There's so much to do. So what they're trying to do is alleviate that pain point. And if you imagine you're moving, your providers, be they electricity, so energy or gas, or you know, broadband or Sky TV, etc. What they're trying to do is alleviate that process, including removals as well. So they have partnerships with people like Pickfords, and about 130 partners in total. So they're trying to ease that process where when you move, it's painless. They do this through using APIs, which enables them to connect with all these other providers. They're working with estate agents to help make that move easier. So they've signed up companies like Hamptons that help them. Again, they operate, or we operate in that space, which was that last check before Series A, and they've now moved on to discussions for their Series A round. So, you know, exciting company. Interesting for us, they're actually based down in Bournemouth, which is quite nice. I mean, a lot of tech investing happens in London and the southeast, which would probably include Bournemouth or maybe southwest. But certainly for us, it's nice to be outside London, which is exciting for us. And they're national, obviously, because 6 million people are moving a year nationally. So it's very much a national company.
Marcus, I want to talk a little bit now about your process. Now, when speaking to people about backing private companies and early stage companies, of course, the founders and the people behind the business are the most important factor for most people when they're looking at a company. But you know, apart from the people that are involved in the company, what would you say are the most important factors that you look for in the companies that you look to back?
Yeah, so we look for 6 criteria. The number one on our list is founder market fit. So you're right, the people aspect is very important. It's around probably 90% of early stage investing, is a lot of it's based on the people. But by founder market fit, what we mean is the founders have worked in the sector. They're very, very knowledgeable on their sector. They have expertise. They're often exited founders, meaning they founded a company and exited from that business before. We often invest in businesses where there are co-founders, where there's more than one person. We like it when there are a couple of people running the show. It's helpful if some of them want a bit of time off, and it's quite lonely being a founder. So solo founders will find it possibly a bit harder. We look for companies that have £10,000 a month in revenue. The reason for that is we want to see that they are already generating those revenues and they've progressed beyond what we might call a side hustle or a kitchen table project. We want to see companies which have a large total addressable market. So we want to see the number of customers being obviously in the millions or more. Although we invest in companies which are UK-based and EIS eligible, obviously, if they can expand beyond the UK into other markets, that's attractive. So that's what we look for in the large total addressable market. Being technology investors, we look for companies which have proprietary technology. So they need to have strong IP, a strong tech stack, ideally a prominent CTO, a chief technical officer in the organization. And we look for companies that have strong network effects. And what we mean by network effects is if you when you use an app and it says, "Hi, Jonathan, welcome back," and it'll kind of pick up where you were, but it'll get better each time you use it with each iteration. That's what we call network effects, because not only is it doing that with you, but with the hundreds of thousands of other users. So as these companies grow and as their apps get better and better and, you know, have more and more users, they get smarter and they're learning. So that's what we call network effects. Large companies like Facebook, Amazon and Google have done it to great effect, but it's very much something that startups look to do as well. If you've got a product that's got 2,000 users and suddenly you grow to 10,000 users, obviously your product is going to get better with each iteration. And then finally, we look for companies which have a path to profitability. So not only do they need to be generating revenue, but we need to be able to invest in companies that have that path to profitability and don't just look for endless, you know, VC checks in a loss-making business. Yeah. And back to the sectors we mentioned earlier, if I look across the board, the fintechs probably become profitable in about 3 years' time, and proptechs probably slightly sooner. And the reason for that is a lot of the fintechs are fairly capital-intensive. They have sometimes 30 to 40 employees, where the proptechs have 10 to 20 employees. So it's just because the fintech market is slightly more mature. And we want those companies to be profitable. We're investors first and foremost, and want to, you know, invest in sensible businesses.
Fantastic. Thank you. So, Marcus, in your portfolio, you have a couple of companies classified as B Corps. Now, one of the reasons why I'm speaking today is because there's some very strong ESG characteristics of Love Ventures and your portfolio company. So would you be able to give listeners a bit of an idea, if they're not familiar with the term B Corp, what a B Corp is?
Yeah, so B Corp is an organization which is independent, which is has a stringent set of criteria to be part of that club and be a B Corp company. So two of the Fund 1 portfolio companies are B Corp companies. That's Circa 5000 and Just Move In that we mentioned earlier. So if we take Circa 5000, let's talk about a new company. They were recently rebranded. They used to be called Ticker. They are an impact investing company and want to give users the ability to invest in really investments for the future. And what we mean by that is they enable people to invest in themes, baskets, if you like. So people or planet and environment. And they will then select what individual sort of investments they go into. So stocks, which might be water stocks or hydro stocks, etc. So Circa 5000 is a B Corp. So they've been through that process to become a B Corp. Number one, they're in that impact and sustainability space themselves. That is their mantra. That's what they do. And so it made sense for them to become a B Corp to show that this is something they care about. And they want to invest in companies for the future that are not destroying the planet, and they're doing good for the planet. So that's very much what they're doing. They're forefront of that. If we look at Just Move In, they did the same thing. They're obviously very proud to be B Corps as well. B Corps, I think, by nature, they have to go through this very stringent process, and they actually got a slightly bad rap recently because of one company. But, you know, moving on from that, I think that the wider B Corp movement is an important one. If you look at investors today, the investors who are maybe 35 and below are the ones that are going to be looking to the future and living on a planet which is overpopulated. It already has, you know, 7 billion people and rising, and resources are limited. So we need to be responsible investors, and B Corp's very much part of that movement. And that's also what Circa 5000.
So you, as a fund, are actually in the process, actually believe you are now carbon neutral. So what does that look like in terms of, you know, managing a portfolio of companies? You know, what have you done to make sure that you yourselves are carbon neutral?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. We were one of the first VCs to become carbon neutral ourselves. What that involved was looking at all our movements and our energy usage for everyone that works at Love Ventures, and then offsetting those carbon emissions for the full year. Now, for us, it wasn't too onerous because we're a small company. And when we did it in the first year in 2020, obviously we had numerous lockdowns, so our movements were fairly limited. But as our movements have increased and our travel has increased, that might include, you know, train journeys, car journeys, or even plane flights. And so we will be looking to offset those emissions going forward. And in fact, we'd probably like to be carbon positive, where we're offsetting more than we're actually using. Now, for us, as I said, it's been relatively easy because we're a small company. But what's important is that we instill that mantra amongst the companies we invest into. So back to Timet that we spoke about earlier, when we met with them during our due diligence process, we said, look, we're carbon neutral and we encourage our investee companies to be the same. And they took this to heart. They met with our partner, B-Zero Carbon, to actually put this in place, and Timet themselves became carbon neutral. So that's the kind of impact that we can have, because they have 40, 45 employees. They're larger than Love Ventures. They became carbon neutral. So allied together, them plus us, that's, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. But do it across the board, and I think we can make a difference. And actually going forward with Fund 2, again, we're going to encourage our investee companies to be carbon neutral. But I think it's likely we might even start imposing it in the term sheets that we write in our investments, i.e., you know, you get a check from us, but we want you to be carbon neutral. And this is not just us doing this, as you're aware, it's a global movement. Lockdown and, you know, COVID has made people reflect, I think, on how we do business and how we move around. If I look at my career and my time in the city, I frequently used to get on a plane to go to places like Geneva to do 4 or 5 meetings and then come back on the same day. And I think some of these things can be done online now. So you can do your first meeting online, get to know someone. If they want a further meeting or a follow-up, sure, go and see them, and maybe you still will get on that plane, but you might not be doing quite so much travel. And we're seeing that across the board. You're seeing that with very large corporates who are absolutely, you know, drastically cutting their travel by 50 to 75% in terms of their travel budgets. So you are seeing a change. Going back to the example of the 35s and under, it's actually a lot of these younger people, the next generation, who are going to be driving this. And it's pushing these ideas forward right up to the top, to board level, and saying, look, it's time to do something. And with the COP meetings coming up in Glasgow, I think it is, obviously the UK is going to be a forefront of that. And I think it's very interesting. So we're just trying to do our little bit to help, if you like. We're only small, but as we grow, that's going to be more and more of an impact. You know, we're going to invest in probably 10 more companies from Fund 2, maybe more. If you add that to 8 companies from Fund 1, that's already 18 companies. And so if we can impose, if you like, or impress on those companies to be carbon neutral, then we're making a difference.
That's quite an interesting point that you've made there around how businesses are behaving. I mean, for you, Marcus, do you feel that the companies that you're looking at and the companies that you'd like to back, do you think that they're companies that may be reacting to what consumers and the general population are doing, or are they companies that are setting out something, a product or a service that really consumers and the population should be using? I mean, is it more of a push from business, or is it a pull from consumer in terms of the businesses that you like to look at?
I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, across that Fund 1 portfolio, the only one that really has done this as part of their mantra, because it is what they're about, is Circa 5000. You know, that is what they do. And so that's something they've done to attract users. The other ones are going concerns as businesses. So obviously, if they become carbon neutral, that's something that they want to do. But what I would say is it's happening on both sides. It's both business and user-led. And again, if I look across the portfolio, the average founder age is probably 32 to 35, roughly. So these are people that are kind of coming through the next generation and going to be around the planet for the next 30, 40 years plus. And they care. They do care. They want to make a difference. What we really need to do, you know, is beyond that, is impress this on larger companies, you know, big S&P 500 or FTSE 100 companies. So that's where the real action is. That's where these companies need to be doing things. They need to be doing more. And that's really for governments globally to be doing, and how they impress on them to do that through tax credits or other things, and for business leaders to be leading on the subject. So you see people like Bill Gates talking about this frequently, and others. You know, that's where it's got to come from. It's got to come from the top. But yes, across our portfolio, I think it's consumer and business led, frankly.
Fantastic. Thank you. So to finish off now, Marcus, for people that are listening to this and would like to know more about Love Ventures and obviously exploring what you do, I mean, what are the key things that you would say to them in terms of what they should keep an eye on from you in the future in terms of your plans for the business and also the companies that you're looking at?
Yeah, so if I take off my Love Ventures hat for a second, let's talk about EIS. EIS is the Enterprise Investment Scheme. It was created by the government in 1994. It offers a series of tax reliefs to individual investors. So they get 30% income tax relief off their investment. That's not applicable to fees. Any gains are exempt from capital gains tax and inheritance tax. There's capital gains tax deferral. And so it's a very interesting asset class. And I only discovered it myself in 2015 when I started angel investing. And that was despite working in the city with all my financial background and city background. So it's a very interesting asset class. Rishi Sunak is a fan of EIS. £1 million invested in the first year alone creates 4 jobs. So it's really something that's very important for the UK economy and the startup system. And at Love Ventures, what we're doing is we are an EIS fund. Fund 2 right now that we're working on is open. We're raising a fund. It's going to make, as I said, 10 new investments into exciting startups in fintech, proptech, and consumer tech. Your listeners can find out more by going to our website, which is loveventures.co.uk. And, you know, really, if you're new to EIS, I would invite you to look at HMRC's website or do some reading about those tax breaks, because it is very advantageous. And as I said, it's something that I discovered, and my first check was £500. It was in 2015, and you know, it's grown from there. So there's no shame in getting started. Companies like Crowdcube and Cedars offer the ability to invest as little as £10 into startups. So with all the caveats around that, an investment, as you know, people can lose all their money. It is a risky asset class, and this is not investment advice. But, you know, as an investor myself, I would say that it should really be part of everyone's portfolio. You should have your investments in pensions and bonds and equities and property. And I think having access to early stage technology in the UK is very, very exciting right now.
Indeed, indeed. Of course, as you mentioned there, investing in startups is not for everybody, and we'd encourage people that are looking at it to do some research and have a good look at the resources that are made available for investors. So, Marcus, thank you very much for joining the podcast today.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The products and investments discussed in this podcast that can be accessed through Kemeny Capital are exclusively for UK high net worth individuals and sophisticated investors. Investments in private companies carry significant risks, including loss of capital, lack of dividends, and illiquidity. You should understand all the risks involved before committing and seek independent advice from a qualified financial advisor. Kemeny Capital does not provide tax or investment advice.